Welcome to Cage Club, Episode 3. This is Valley Girl. That's Mike Manzi. I'm Joey Lewandowski. We're glad that you're back. I have never seen Valley Girl before. I just watched it for the first time. Mike, I think you were just telling me that you had seen it before. Have you seen it a lot, or have you just seen it once a long time ago, or what's your experience with it?
I've seen it before. I haven't seen it recently, probably 15, 20 years ago, I'd say. A good 15 years. But at that time, I watched it quite a bit on VHS. So what did you think of Valley Girl for your first time?
I liked it a lot. It was sort of, I realized that, you know, Nicolas Cage is top billed, and this is, and I think it's important to talk about now, that he's no longer Nicolas Coppola. He's Nicolas Cage.
Yeah.
He wanted to break free from Francis Ford. He wanted to sort of set his own path. He didn't want to rely on the nepotism of having, you know, one of the most famous directors be one of his relatives. So he apparently, according to Wikipedia, and I think I've heard this before, he took his stage name from Luke Cage, the Marvel character, who later this year or maybe next year is going to have his own Netflix series. And so I think it would be really, really amazing if Nicolas Cage had like a cameo or like a recurring role on the Luke Cage TV series.
It'd be great if he could revive his Ghost Rider character on that.
Yes.
Him and Luke Cage could team. Maybe he'll appear as Ghost Rider in the Marvel movies again. That'd be great. But, I mean, he is a big comic book fan, so that's really interesting. I never heard that, but that makes sense to me. You know, a guy who names his son Kal-El would take his stage name from a comic book hero as well, you know?
Because it's such like a strong, sort of bold name, and I was trying to figure out where it was coming from. But yes, it's named after Luke Cage, and we are here. Movie 3, he's now the top-billed actor. He's now a star pretty much the rest of his career. I mean, there's some movies where he's not the lead, but, you know, this is the first of many where he's the top-billed person. But really, and I wrote this down later in the movie, there are long stretches of this movie where he's just not in it.
Yeah, he's not necessarily the lead character. I think, you know, the titular Valley Girl is Julie, you know, and it's, for the most part, her journey. And, you know, she does meet Randy very early, but you're right. He sort of disappears here and there. He's mostly there to service her story.
Yes. I guess it's not called Punk Kid from Hollywood.
Yeah.
It's called Valley Girl for a reason. We are following her as opposed to following him.
Yeah. But yeah, you know, that would be great if there was some sort of companion movie that was called Hollywood Boy.
Yeah, absolutely. I was looking into, you know, who directed this movie, who wrote this movie, what Deborah Foreman, as you said, the titular Valley Girl, what else she's been in. And Martha Coolidge, I think the only other movie that she's done that I've seen is Real Genius. You know, there aren't too many female directors. It's something that a lot of people have talked about in other places, that it's sort of, you know, there's no reason for there not to be female directors, but there's just not a lot. The only other thing that I thought was sort of funny was that she did Valley Girl in 83, and then her next movie was called City Girl. I don't think they're related at all.
I've never heard of it, but it could be a coincidence.
It only has 33 reviews on IMDb, so I don't think it ever was, you know, released to any great extent, but I just thought it was funny that she did Valley Girl and then she did City Girl.
Interesting. Sort of a pseudo-sequel, perhaps.
Maybe.
Further investigation required.
Exactly.
It's funny how, you know, you do bring up an interesting point about female directors, and yet we're three movies in, and this movie and the last movie were both directed by women.
It's true.
Yeah. Amy Heckerling directing Fast Times, and then Martha Coolidge directing Valley Girl. And all three movies so far ending at a dance.
Yes. I was noticing that there are lots of school dances in all of these movies.
We are dealing with high school teenagers, but still, I was a little surprised. We're 3 for 3.
Lots of shopping, and also Cage on the beach again.
Cage again. I'm convinced he hasn't left the beach.
Introduced again on the beach.
Introduced sort of in a Daniel Craig Casino Royale-esque coming out of the beach, almost like, you know, from the girl from Dr. No. That's what I thought for some reason.
Pretty much. I mean, it's not as impressive an introduction. He's not doing one-arm push-ups. He's just sort of standing there. But he's catching the eye of all these Valley girls, especially Julie, who says, "What a hunk." So now, I think the important thing, and I thought, you know, it's not like it's some real secret subtext, but I thought for a little bit that I'm like, oh, just, you know, it's a modern day Romeo and Juliet. And then I saw their names. It's Randy and Julie, R and J. And I was like, oh, that's really cool. And then about halfway through the movie, they're just walking down the street in front of a theater, and they walk away, and the camera just stays on the marquee that just says Romeo and Juliet. It's like, hey, in case you didn't realize, this is a modern-day Romeo and Juliet.
Yeah, it kind of reveals that sort of early on, if you know Romeo and Juliet, I feel. But it goes from subtle to, you know, blatant to, you know,
yeah.
Haven't noticed, we're hitting you over the head with it. But that, it works so well as an adaptation of Romeo and Juliet. I don't miss any of the side characters, you know, like, I wasn't like, who's the Tibble?
There's like Benvolio and all these different names, and I was trying to see if the name, the initials, just like, you know, Randy and Julie match up, if any other initials matched up, and there was nothing, you know, immediately apparent.
They meet at a party, right?
Yeah.
And like, they're from two different sides of the tracks in this case, but in Romeo and Juliet, just two of the two warring family factions. So, yeah, everything except that neither of them die at the end, which is...
Neither of them die.
Which is great. I'm so glad they don't die.
Because you sort of wonder, when you realize that it's Romeo and Juliet, you think, oh no, is he going to die at the end? Spoiler alert, they ride off into the sunset, happily ever after.
There is a moment during the Dark Knight of Cage where I was a little scared for him toward the end of this movie, that he got into that self-destructive mode, and
he almost got into a fight with those guys in that car.
Yeah, and his friend told him they would have killed him.
Yeah.
It was like a reference to the end of Romeo and Juliet.
He was really close to dying.
And twice, early on, someone asks if he has a death wish, so there's like these allusions to the ending that they never do, which is still pretty cool. You could have their cake and eat it too.
So I guess going back to the beginning, there were two other things that I've noticed that are sort of consistent through the first three Cage movies that we've watched. All three have been, I think, in or around L.A. Like, he's not straying too far. They're all pretty much the same movie, in a sense. And now it's two movies in a row with a Brad.
Huh. Interesting.
There was a Brad in Fast Times, right?
Yeah, Bradley. The role that he was supposed to play, that Judd...
Exactly, yes. Right. Brad's bud.
Yeah.
Yeah, so two movies in a row with a Brad. I think Brad is just sort of a stereotypical 80s name.
We have the good Brad, and now we have the evil Brad.
The bad Brad.
Oh, I'm thinking Tommy. I'm sorry. Which one is Brad? His friend?
Brad's Tommy's friend. I don't know if you ever really talk about... They say Brad's name a lot.
He was wearing that amazing sort of windbreaker, right? That pastel...
Yeah, the pastel red, yellow, and blue one. Yes.
Yeah, amazing. It like blows off Julie. And then Tommy comes up and is like, he blew you off.
Oh, also, one other thing before we get off track. It's two movies in a row that I noticed with that same Devo poster. The whole band with the red hats on.
Oh, no kidding.
Hmm. Yes. So it's really like they took Fast Times and then just sort of made it worse. Like, I like Valley Girl, but it's not as good, I don't think, as a movie as Fast Times.
Yeah, it's following maybe one or two characters from Fast Time all the way through, you know?
Right.
And I think it might even go to show, if you had done that with Fast Times, that movie may not be as interesting, you know, that there might not be enough there for an entire movie with each of those characters. And here it gets, because they can lean on Romeo and Juliet, they have more material to work with there.
Sure.
That's like a great thing to hang this film on.
Yeah.
But you're right. It feels almost Fast Times light, or like this is what another high school at the same year, you know, this is going on across town or something to that effect.
Right. Although if they were happening in the same universe, the girls in this movie would not be friends with Jennifer Jason Leigh and Phoebe Cates.
Yeah.
Because these girls are like the biggest prudes in the world. And they're just like talking about, like basically talking about how icky sex is. And that's sort of what everything about Fast Times is about. Which again sort of goes back to the most realistic depiction of high school.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, of the three that we've seen, this one's sort of like an idealized version, almost kind of like, you know, what parents want their kids to be doing. The Best of Times is sort of like written by people who apparently have never been teenagers, who have no idea what's going on. And then Fast Times is sort of more of an honest kind of realistic depiction of kids and what they're doing and what they're saying and how they're talking and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, this movie is a little more like of a stereotype of teenagers, I feel, but the way that they talk and their mannerisms and their materialistic nature, it's all very heightened to a degree, I believe, than an actual reality, just a little bit, just to sort of show you know, their differences culturally from where they live, you know, Hollywood versus the Valley, just showing the contrast. I just feel like Nick Cage, kids like that, I don't know, he just seems like he's putting on a tougher front than he would, and she seems like she's putting on more of, like, this airheady front than she would. Whereas in, like, Fast Times, like, everyone just felt very natural.
Definitely. I guess we should probably go through the movie. So, the Valley Girls, so we have Julie, and we have her best friend, Stacy, and they have their other friend, Susie, and they have some fourth girl whose name I don't know.
Played by Dottie from Pee-wee's Big Adventure.
Yes.
I think she was Lauren or Lori.
Some generic, you know, Valley Girl name. The four of them were just at the beach talking about a big party that's going to happen that night, and they see Nick Cage and his punk rock friend. His friend overhears where the party is, so the two of them go to the party. The four Valley Girls are there. Julie had just broken up with her boyfriend, doesn't want to talk to him. She sort of has this crush on Nick Cage. They show up. They sort of have a good time. Then they get kicked out. After they get kicked out, they're driving away, and then Nick Cage pops out of his car and has one of the greatest, I think to this point, the best Nick Cage moment in his career. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, he's been pretty reserved in this film, especially mostly relying on looks and things of like that, and his batting his eyes and stuff like that.
He's almost like Ryan Gosling-y for the first part of this movie.
That's a good call.
Like, just like a really pretty boy who just like looks at you and makes you fall in love with him.
Right, he's got those like puppy dog eyes, right? And he's the strong, silent type at this point.
But he's got better hair than Ryan Gosling's ever had.
He's got this feathered coif that just, I don't know, I don't know how they did that. That's Hollywood.
His hair is on point in this movie.
Yeah.
What I'm kind of sad about is on the DVD cover, his hair is like dyed blue and pink, and it's like more spiked, and it's like, it's crazier than it ever is in the movie, and I was sort of hoping for that, but I guess the DVD cover, like, he has, like, some outfit and some hairdo that he never wears in the movie that's just, like, the pinnacle of crazy punk rock Cage. And I'm sort of sad that we didn't get that, but I'm also really happy with the final product of what his hair actually looked like in the movie.
Yeah, while he's got it, he makes it work really well. He's pulling it off here today.
Exactly. And so, as they're driving away, Cage pulls over, gets out of his car, and has the best monologue to this point.
Who the fuck was that guy, huh? And I was doing all right with that chick. Who the fuck does he think he is?
Well, maybe he's your boyfriend.
You know, nobody is gonna tell me who I can score with. I want this chick, she wants me, so fuck it, we're going back.
So, after he has this amazing monologue and decides that they have to go back to the party, they get back to the party. But one thing that's sort of interesting, we were sort of talking about this earlier, you really liked how he describes Julie. Like the words that he uses, the sort of, you know, the rhetoric that he uses.
Yeah, the vernacular in this movie is interesting in the way everybody talks. You know, you definitely have the Valley speak, that the people in the Valley, mostly the girls are speaking it, and it's almost like Clockwork Orange to a degree sometimes, where you're trying to decipher them. And then even Cage, you know, throws out a couple lines when he's right after he's love struck and tossed from the party, and he's telling his best friend, you know, about what happened, and he just says,
"That chick Julie, she's truly dazzling."
Yep. She's not one of ours.
You know, and that's just such an interesting phrase to use, dazzling, you know, and just wasn't expecting him to come up with that one. I just thought maybe he would be like, that chick is bitching, right? She rocks my world, you know?
Yeah, it's a very eloquent turn of phrase for someone characterized as like this kid from the wrong side of the tracks.
Yeah, they portray him as trash, but he's actually quite sensitive. That we will see that sensitivity come, you know, Julie brings that out of him.
Oh, definitely.
And I almost wonder if he was aware he was that sensitive to begin with, and he's not discovering it for the first time as well.
So they get back to the party, and instead of walking in the front door, like, I'm not sure.
This is awesome.
It's a weird plan for anybody to have.
But it's so, a plan is what I love. Like, it's such
it's a plan.
Teenage thing, like, to do.
So they're kicked out of the party, and then they finally get back to the party. And instead of walking in the front door, Cage climbs, it looks like, to the second floor bathroom and climbs through the window. And instead of, you know, going out into the party and trying to find Julie, he just gets in the shower and sits in the shower and waits and waits and waits for Julie to go to the bathroom. And they show, you know, four or five groups of kids come in, people making out, people smoking weed, people just doing their makeup. Nobody actually using the bathroom for a bathroom purpose.
Oh, yeah, that's interesting. No one did actually come in to use the bathroom.
It's just sort of like they could have played that for a comedic moment. They could have played that for him being like in an awkward situation. They just didn't do it. Everybody's using the bathroom for literally every other purpose.
I think it was just to sort of show off, like, the fashion, for one. Like, everyone in the, like, the valley fashion of the 80s. And then just, like, what kids do at parties. So you sort of see a little bit of this and stuff like Clueless as well. Well, they'll just be like, you know, we just got to cover the party. And, you know, since he's in the bathroom, what kind of stuff goes on there during parties?
One thing I did notice in the bathroom scene, and it's something that we've seen in this and in Fast Times, there's so much casual nudity in 80s movies. Where just like girls just take their shirts off, you know, in these movies because they're making out with guys. It's sort of something that, like, I would think were only in horror movies, but it just seems like anytime you have like 18 or 19 or 20 year old girls in 80s movies, they just take their shirts off.
Yeah, I almost wondered if it's like they know they're making an art film and they're gonna have that rating anyway, you know, for language or content,
sure,
or whatever. So maybe they're just like, you know what, like, to go all the way, you know, make it raunchy, right? Like,
yes,
let's really just, you know, go all out with it. Just earn it if you're gonna have it. And they do earn it in this one. There's like four topless shots from, like,
yeah,
four. And there's like a poster on a kid's bedroom wall where a girl is like half topless too.
Yeah, shit, that's there. And then in Fast Times, all over Spicoli's room, it's naked women.
Yeah.
It's just weird to have, like, I think it's weird today just to have naked women on your walls. But I guess, hey, this is early 80s. You're on a movie set. It's just totally normal.
I think it's like pre-internet. People might forget how valuable Playboy was, especially like that long ago, you know. So that's all you got. That's all you got until you saw one in person.
Yes.
So on the bedroom wall it went.
Because, like, in Fast Times, Spicoli's talking to Forrest Whitaker's younger brother, and they're talking about the new centerfold,
yeah,
and just talking about how big her boobs are. Like, that's just, like, a topic of conversation. Like, that's not a thing that people talk about anymore because we take everything for granted.
Yeah, like, we used to talk about, you know, the swimsuit issue, Sports Illustrated, right? Like,
right.
That sort of faded out, too.
Yep.
It's a great sign of the times.
So, finally, after waiting through basically half the party coming to the bathroom, Julie finally comes into the bathroom. Nick Cage comes out of the shower and just walks up behind her, and she doesn't freak out. Like, I don't know how you don't freak out in that situation.
She thought he was so rad for doing it, you know? Like, he's totally nuts for coming back to this party, and she just loves that about him.
But it's almost like she was expecting to see him there. Like, she just doesn't react. She just, like, looks up and smiles.
That's a good point, too. That could be part of sort of the love-struck nature of their relationship, because they do fall in love at first sight. It's like you hear Cupid's arrow type stories, you know?
Sure.
Like, they say hi to each other and they're already in love with each other, you know? And
I think she's in love with him just by seeing him on the beach.
Yeah. Yeah. And him seeing her, he doesn't even see her eyes. She's wearing sunglasses and he's still like, that's the girl of my dreams.
It all happens real fast. And he even, like, tells her that he loves her really, really fast. Like, in, like, the second or third time they're hanging out, they're already on to, I love you.
Well, I also think it could just be, they need to speed things up, obviously. They don't have, you know, they can't tell a four-hour movie. But it also sort of goes to show the kids' thought process, you know?
Yeah.
Like, also, like Romeo and Juliet, like, you know, you're the only one for me till the end of time. And it's like, well, you're crazy. You guys are, like, 15, you know? You know nothing. But, like, it's great for storytelling purposes when kids just, like, fall in love and, like, that's all that matters to them.
Right. Julie and Randy are in the bathroom, and he convinces her to leave the party. And so she grabs Stacy, and they leave, and they go on a double date. The weirdest part of this double date is they're driving down, you know, Hollywood Boulevard or whatever, some bustling L.A. street, and Nick Cage knows everybody in the city. And they all know him, and they can all hear him as he's driving and yelling to them, and he's just having conversations with everyone. Like, this guy is, again, like he was king of the beach In the best of times, he is the king of Hollywood.
Yeah.
He's Valley Girl.
Yeah, he's the king of the strip. You're right. It's just, he comes alive. You know, they cross the border. He's back in his hometown, in his element. And, you know, he can be himself. He's not, you know, reserved like he was at the party.
And as much in his element as he is, she is just as far out of her element. Especially, I mean, she's sort of along for the ride because she's there with him. Stacy is, like, real uncomfortable. I mean, I wouldn't be comfortable in her position, too, if I was sort of thrust upon this double date with that weirdo friend of Nick Cage's.
Yeah, she feels kidnapped.
She does feel kidnapped, and I think rightfully so.
Yeah, because she was kidnapped. By...
Exactly. This is sort of where we have the Cage advice, where we talk about the advice that somebody gives, usually Nick Cage gives to someone, the moment that rings true in the film. And he's just talking to Julie and Stacy at the part at this punk rock club, and he says, you know, this is the real world. It's not fresh and clean like a television show. This is what living is. This is what you're missing out on.
Yeah.
So we're going to play a little bit of a clip here just so you can get a sense of what his Cage advice actually is.
You guys think it's so different, don't you?
We are. We're ourselves.
Oh, and we're not?
You're like her. And all the rest of her friends, you're all fucking programmed.
So what is it like to be so free?
That's a good question.
So I kind of thought that was going pretty deep for this type of movie, you know, up until now. There weren't any real proclamations about existence or anything like that. We were just
there's a couple real weird, like, tonal shifts. Like, this is one of them. Another one, and this is back at the party, when Tommy's making out with that girl in the amazing one-piece red jumpsuit.
Yeah.
And she, like, stops him when they're making out and says, hey, does this mean that we're together now? And he basically just says, no, it means that you're a bad friend for cheating on your friend with her boyfriend when they're on the rocks.
Yeah.
And then he leaves, and she just, like, sits there in silence, just looking incredibly sad for, like, 3 or 4 seconds.
It was... ultra realistic. I think that came with having a female director, you know. I think that might have hit close to home at on some level. But you're right, like, it sets up just how much of a dick Tommy is, right? That's Julie's ex-boyfriend, right? And
right.
It's so much happier for her to be with Randy now, you know, that if he's, like, scheming on, you know, her friends like this, what was he doing when they were dating?
Right.
Just so glad they're not together. No.
And, like, you know, he is not good to Stacy. He slut-shames this poor girl, who I don't even know if she has a name or not.
It's Lauren.
Lauren.
Yeah.
Lauren, I feel bad for you. I love your one-piece jumpsuit. I feel bad that this guy took advantage of you. After the Cage advice, when they're in the club, they have their first kiss. And I think this is the first kiss that Nick Cage has ever had on screen. Right?
First on-screen Cage kiss.
It's a landmark and a milestone and history here in Cage Club.
I don't usually think of him in romance. I struggle to think of romantic Cage. Well, I guess when we get to Leaving Las Vegas, we'll see him kissing a little more often. But
sure. But there's a couple of movies coming up that I'm not too familiar with that seem like they could be romantic. You know, Peggy Sue Got Married, Moonstruck. I don't know exactly what they're about, but I feel like they could maybe have romantic subplots. But this one is really a romance at its heart.
Yeah, and they kiss a lot on their first day that they met.
Yeah.
They're right into it.
They go to some overlook and they're just making out while Randy's friend and Stacy are just, like, he's just chasing her around the car.
Yes.
And they sort of kiss a little bit and then she just, like, freaks out and can't do it anymore.
Yeah, she plays hard to get. She'll give in eventually.
And she's not happy with her situation either, but she's not willing to give it up, to accept that yet.
Yeah, she's got that syndrome when you sympathize with your captors and things.
She's got Stockholm syndrome.
Stockholm syndrome, that's it, yeah. That's what it's coming on.
One thing that's really, really weird about this movie is that, well, first of all, we need to talk about how Nick Cage is literally 18 years old and does not look like any 18-year-old I've ever seen.
Yeah, playing his age here.
And he really could be, he looks like he's in his mid to late 20s.
Yeah, I think part of it's the height, part of it is the chest hair, which he is shaved into a quasi-Superman logo. That's all I was thinking. I mean, just because of the recent news of him, you know, at one time he was going to be Superman. I see his chest hair, the way it's shaped, like a triangle in this, and I just...
It's like his family crest.
It's all I could think. It's all I could think this time.
So he's 18. All these kids are pretty much, I was looking up at some of their ages, they're all about 20, so they're all playing, you know, roughly their own age. But these moms of these girls are like 35 years old. They're way too young and way too attractive to be moms of high school girls.
I think in the case of the girl who's throwing the, you know, the mom who tries to get with Skip, the...
Yeah, I looked her name is Lee Purcell, and she was 35 when this movie came out.
I believe her character, there's one line at the party where she says, I'm just the stepmother, after her father passed away, she's gotten so competitive. So I think that girl's being raised by her stepmother, and that can account for why they're close in age.
Okay, and I guess, and Stacy's mom, she and her dad just got married in September, or whatever they were saying, because they still have the pictures from the wedding on the... So maybe that she's not her mom either? Maybe that's a stepmom?
Yeah, and it seems, you know, to delve further into the California stereotype, it seems very California to me, with the divorce and the multiple marriages. I mean, this comes up, again, I mentioned Clueless, but, you know, her dad was on, like, his fourth marriage. So, I don't know, I just sort of chalked it up to part of the culture.
But what's really weird is that when Skip comes over and Susie's mom, I don't know her character's name, but played by Lee Purcell, is hitting on him, just hitting on this high school kid, and he turns her down, which I don't know who would turn her down, but anyway.
I think he's just dense.
But then later in the movie, isn't he like having sex with Susie in their mom's bed?
Yeah, I think it's supposed to be sort of like this mystery as to who, like, you're supposed to think, you know, it's like misdirection. It's the red herring of the movie, you know. You think he likes the mom, but it turns out he always liked the daughter.
I thought for a second he was with a guy in the bed, and then I realized it was the daughter. But then, like, it's like this mystery that just has no resolution. Like, you just find out, and then they just never talk about it again. They never show it again.
Oh, they're late to the junior prom with the cups because...
Oh, that's true, yeah.
To get it on.
You know, the cup, the hanging thread, the loose thread about the cups.
Yeah.
First of all, I don't know why kids are tasked to bring paper goods and plastics and cups and whatever to a prom, first of all. And number two, I don't know why only one person has to bring the cups. It just seems like poor planning.
Yeah, that's a good point right there. You know, is it maybe it was saying something about, you know, the making of this film. It was like a very low budget movie and they didn't have a lot of money, so they're trying to express that.
So after Randy and Julie have their first date, he shows up at her parents' restaurant called Foods for Health.
Yes.
And he's like hiding behind a plant, I guess just to be funny, and then he walks up and the dad is just totally cool with him. He just loves Nick Cage.
Well, this dad is like, can we talk about him just for a minute? I know it's not his podcast, but, you know,
he's kind of the best character in this movie.
He is amazing. It's the cook from Apocalypse Now. I don't know.
Is it?
Yeah. And I heard the one who plays his wife, she's in the deleted scenes of Apocalypse Now. I think she's one of the playgirls that gets stuck and not.
Okay.
Anyway, his character is like this ex-hippie stoner, health food nut. So
yeah.
Like, he just comes across like very well in this movie. Like, he's hilarious, you know? He almost steals it.
And he and his new wife are totally okay with Julie being out all night on their first date. She shows up at like 6 or 7 in the morning. And the mom is in the weirdest, most awkward yoga pose in the world.
It's like
when she walks in.
If you don't know yoga.
Basically pivoting her entire pelvic area toward the camera, and it just hovers there while she has lines.
Yeah, it doesn't look like an actual exercise move. It looks like something someone says, do exercise. Just got into
that. And she did exercise, and it's so weird. But they're both totally okay with her because Julie needs to become her own person.
Yeah, grounding you is bad karma, so, you know, we don't want that.
Yes, so when Nick Cage shows up to the restaurant, the dad's like, oh yeah, you guys can go because she has flexible hours, so she doesn't have to be there when she wants to be there. It seems like she's like headed for a real rude awakening in the real world. But, I mean, I guess she always has Foods for Health that she can work at.
Exactly. As soon as this movie's over, her life is going straight to hell.
And then later in the movie, and I don't want to skip too far ahead, but he basically has another round of Cage advice where Julie goes to him and she's just like, I don't know what to do. I don't know whether I should date Tommy or I should date Randy. And he's just basically like, you have to do what feels right. And I guess what feels right is sort of hanging out with her friends instead of hanging out with the man she loves.
Yeah, he says, you know, like, follow your heart. And she kind of succumbs to the peer pressure of her friends. And, you know, her friends get on her case, you know, you're not hanging out with us. And she just sort of caves.
I really don't understand why her friends wouldn't let her hang out with Nick Cage.
I think it's just, you know, prejudice, right? Like, they don't understand that they share, like, she says it herself, she doesn't even understand the bond, but she feels the connection, right? She's like, it doesn't even make sense to me, but I feel like we belong together. It's sort of a lesson as to, like, you know, if you could look past someone's cover and read the book, you might get like them, you know, you might see an entirely different person than you thought was in front of you. So I think they're just like, you know, they're these materialistic high school girls who like Tommy because he's everything they were told they should try and obtain. And they're, you know, the girl they idolize isn't doing that, right? Like, she's prom queen and, like, she's going to blow it. And, like, they're more concerned than her. So I don't know. I think that's what's going on.
I mean, I think they could all learn something from Nick Cage, who, when they're at the Rock Club, he says something along the lines of, we do the same things, but it's the way we do things that makes a difference.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're all just kids. We're all just looking to have a good time. It's just the way we go about doing it is different. And just sort of open your mind, have a good time at this Rock Club, live a little, enjoy Hollywood. You don't have to always live in the valley.
Yeah. You know, if you open up a little more, you might end up having more fun than you were having, right? Yeah.
Exactly. Open your mind to new opportunities.
So just wanted to mention quickly, you know, we get our first montage here of them in love as they leave the health food store. It looks like it covers like a couple weeks, maybe a week at least.
It's a lot of them walking down major boulevards in L.A.
Yeah, there's, you know, he drops her off one night. They go and they get like a malt somewhere. They hang out at that place, that same place, very often. It seems like a local hangout. To someone, they go to the mall, and it's all scored perfectly to
Modern English, I Melt With You, which again plays over the closing credits. It came out in 1982, reached number 7 on the Billboard Top Tracks. It became popular because of MTV and because of the ending titles and the Falling in Love montage sequence in Valley Girl in the same year.
Right.
So this movie is a big reason why that song is still a song that we know and remember and recognize.
Excellent.
Which is amazing. It's a great song. It fits the montage perfectly. I'm not sure that it really works over the closing credits, but it doesn't really matter. I mean, they are melting with you, and they are going off living together or whatever. So I guess it does work over the closing credits. I take that back. But that's sort of like the song of their romance.
Yeah, it sums them up perfectly, right? Time has frozen so that they could fall in love.
But then, you know, Julie's under pressure from her friend. She talks to her dad. Her dad says, follow your heart. And she breaks up with Nick Cage. But Nick Cage shows up to her house and knocks on her door. And she, just out of nowhere, to him at least, is just so mean.
Yeah.
He's done nothing to warrant this. And she just does not want to have anything to do with him.
I mean, she could... I mean, again, she is... They are teenagers, but you would think that she could just be honest and explain that her friends are pressuring her to stop hanging out with them. But I guess we wouldn't have the conflict that we want. So, you know, she totally just, like, I hate to use this word, but she just goes into full bitch mode. Like,
she does.
You know, like, it's just very, I was like, whoa, it was like, let him down a little easy, but it's like, she really, like, tries to make it that he never wants to see her again.
But we do have to give her credit for the way that she did it, because it inspires him to have the first real Cage meltdown in his career. And it is the best reaction to a breakup I think I've ever seen in a movie.
You can't save me anymore.
Is it your father? Is it your mother? Just let me talk to them. I can really fix
No, them. There's nothing to fix. It's not them. It's not them at all. It's me, okay? I can't see you anymore, okay?
Okay. Okay. I know what it is. I know what it is.
I know what this is. It's your fucking friends, right? Shit, Julie, I mean, what is this? It's between you and me, not between the rest of the fucking world, so fuck off! It's your friends! Well, fuck you! Now fuck off for sure! Like, totally!
Yeah, and I think this leads into The Dark Knight of the Soul for Nick Cage, where...
which features the weirdest on-screen vomiting I've ever seen.
Well, we'll get to that. First first, he gets, like, I mean, now you can see, you know, we're getting a little preview of leaving Las Vegas here. He gets shit-faced.
Like, he's willing right now, his character right now, is willing to drink himself to death.
Like, he is talking to himself.
Yeah.
He's just wandering the streets of L.A., talking to himself and drinking. And then he wanders into the club, right, like his hangout, and I guess he runs into his ex-girlfriend, Samantha.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I mean, they don't say boyfriend, girlfriend, but he's like, you know, she's like, I wasn't looking for you. And he's like, I haven't been looking for you, like, for a while. And then they, like, go into the bathroom and they bang?
I guess. But what's weird, what I don't understand, and maybe you can explain to me, is while they're making out in the stall, these two girls come in to smoke a cigarette. And he's just like, he's more into them than into Samantha. And I guess that's just showing that, you know, he really only wants to be with Julie. He's not really into Samantha.
Yeah.
But it's just weird how much devotion or how much attention he's paying other people instead of the girl that he's making out with as he's looking around.
Yeah, I took that as, like, he's down the spiral. Like, it's not even pleasurable. He's just doing it to sort of dig a deeper ditch for himself, you know, mentally and emotionally, to sort of crawl back out of at this point. Or should never crawl out of, right? He wants to die. He wanders out of the club and challenges, like, a gang of like, Hispanic gang.
Well, they flick a cigarette at him. And then he, like, basically just barks at them. And then the guy comes out, and he's holding a cane, but he's not holding a cane because he needs a cane. He's holding a cane basically because he's a pimp. That's always the wrong guy to mess with.
Yeah. You know, he'll use that cane as a weapon because he doesn't need it because he has a limp.
He has
the other reason I can think of him needing a cane is as a weapon.
Yes. And so out of nowhere, his friend from earlier in the movie comes and grabs him and, like, rushes him down the side alley. And the car of, you know, people about to kill him drive away. Nick Cage is so blackout drunk, so messed up, so brokenhearted that he doesn't even recognize his friend.
Yeah, he doesn't even recognize his friend. He tries to pick a fight with him.
And he's like, hey, man, it's me. It's your friend. They're trying to have a conversation, and this is the weirdest vomiting on screen. It's like they didn't have it in their budget to have, like, fake vomit. He just turns his head into the shadows against the wall and just, like, makes vomiting noises.
I don't feel so good.
I'm gonna be sick. Come on, leave me alone.
What's extra weird about it is there's no, like, ADR vomit, like, hitting the concrete noise. You know what I'm saying? Like, there's no splash after. It's just him going, like, heaving. And he doesn't even really wipe any spittle away from his mouth afterwards. So I'm wondering if he's just dry heaving at this point. But he does say, I'm sick. So I think he's supposed to be really vomiting for real.
It's very strange. Whatever, you know, his intent is, it's real weird.
It's a bizarre performance. I mean, well, it's very Cage.
But then he has the idea. He decides that he's going to win Julie back no matter what it takes. And he goes into this sequence of scenes that are legitimately, like, charming and funny and romantic. It wins Julie back and eventually. And, like, rightfully so, because she's loving. She is loving how focused he is, how dedicated he is.
This is like Cage undercover, right? Master of disguise time. Like, he is just going to pop up wherever she is. Like, you know, he doesn't, but he would jump out of, like, a garbage can and be like, you know, I love you.
Yeah.
But yeah.
At first, like, she gets picked up to go to school, and then as she closes the door, he just hops in the other door. And all of her friends freak out and leave the car, and they just have a little bit of a talk. And then he enters this Masters of Disguise thing.
Well, he requests a song for her on the radio, which was, like, super 80s. I don't even know if people do that anymore because radio is sort of...
Yeah, well, nobody listens to the radio. I don't even know what the equivalent of that would be.
I don't know, skywriting something? I don't even know at this point.
I think that's... it's just sort of like, you know, I don't know.
That's
creating a Spotify playlist for someone?
right? Yeah, that's just another thing lost to time.
So he requests a song for her, and she's in her bedroom with her friend, and she smiles or whatever.
He hides pictures of himself in her history book.
Which is adorable.
Flipping through the pages and sees like these little pictures of him.
He then is like the ticket taker at a movie theater.
Oh, that's the best. He's got the 3D glasses on and the red bow tie and everything.
And none of her friends recognize him, but she does and smiles, and he's just, and they're like, oh man, is it a 3D movie?
Oh, and he goes, no, but your face is.
Which doesn't make any sense, but it's still great. And then he does, you know, probably my favorite. He's like a guy like on roller skates at a burger joint,
yeah.
And comes out and then just gives them their food and then spits his gum on Tommy. And Tommy just brushed off. He's just like, oh man, what a nerd.
Appears as though you forgot our french fries and our coke, fish head.
Oh, well, Peter Piper picked a pepper. I guess I did. Oh, I'm sorry.
That's nuts. What a geek.
Yeah, like, Cage tries to make it supposed to look like an accident and stuff, but, like, he's really, as much as he's trying to get Julie back, he's trying to get to Tommy as well and, like, irk him.
And Tommy he's just so dumb that he doesn't get it.
Yeah, he's too dense as well. Like, there's something in the water in the valley, I suppose, that the boys are clueless.
But it's the great... That's like, it's not like a montage, like it's not set to music, it's not like the I Melt With You montage from earlier, but it's sort of, you know, a montage and like a sequence of like little things, and I just love it entirely and completely.
Now I think this is the last one when she wakes up and she like looks out the window and he's been sleeping in her
oh yeah.
Heart. It's like, it's like Say Anything to the 100th power.
It's basically like if Say Anything, if he got tired of holding up the boombox and then brought out a sleeping bag and just fell asleep, and then she woke up to that.
Yeah.
I don't know what his plan was there, because, I mean, she's on the first floor. He could just knock on her window.
Her parents love him. Like, he could just be like, talk to them. Like, that would be a cool scene, trying to, like, talk to her dad and be like, you know, what's up with Julie? And the dad can just be like, she'll come around, man. Like, you know, she's just not used to this or something.
Exactly.
It could have been interesting, but it doesn't happen. I understand, you know.
But anyway, so then it comes time for prom.
Prom.
He doesn't win her back, but he's sort of in her heart. He gets back on her good graces, and they get ready for prom. And to this point, I hate Tommy. You're supposed to hate Tommy. But I have to say, his pink suit is amazing.
There's something about him in that pink suit that makes you go, like, I bet, like, he's not really that bad. Like, if I didn't see him almost date rape someone, like, if that scene wasn't in the movie, I'd kind of think different about Tommy.
But that suit is so amazing that it almost erases all the other flaws that he's built up to this point.
Well, I don't know. I can't get over that early scene of him at the party. It's just super, it's like him kicking a dog or...
That's true.
Shooting a kid.
I did say almost. I'm not going to give
you did.
I'm not going to like completely wipe the slate clean.
Why do you love Tommy now? I just
love Tommy. But then they go to prom. Health food dad is freaking out because his little girl is growing up. There's like he's having his he's living his own movie while this movie is going on.
He is, and he's like in the middle of like a flashback for filming Apocalypse Now at this point. Like the actor, I seriously freaking out.
He freaks out. He goes to quote look for the camera, but he just goes to the bathroom and just like lights up a joint just because he can't deal with his girl growing up. And like they pay like he's basically. We know more about him than almost everybody else in the movie. And he's barely in the movie.
Yeah.
It's wonderful. So they finally get to the dance. And again, like the one thing that like sort of I remember most about the dance, which is just so weird, and it might be a song of the era. I'm going to look it up right now. It is. And maybe it's... There's the song, Johnny, Are You Queer Boy?
Yeah, by Josie Cotton, who they got to play the dance.
Which is... It's so weird.
Yeah, last week we had in Ridgemont High, you know, the instead of the kick me sign, the I'm a homo sign, and
yep.
Now we have the Are You Queer song.
So. It's like they're aware of gay people, but they're not okay with it. It's sort of the same way, like, I don't think it's fair that this punk band can dress like Nick Cage and all these preppy Valley kids at Valley High are okay with them because they're sort of the entertainment.
Right.
But Nick Cage dresses, you know, in his, not even like super extreme, he just sort of dresses differently than they do, and it's like too much for them to handle.
Maybe it's just that they're a band, they're supposed to look like eccentric, but kids are supposed to look like you, so like Nick Cage is just too different. I don't know, I'm just trying to justify it.
And then, so Nick Cage and his friend, they don't even have to sneak into the prom. They just sort of, like, walk into prom.
Well, we don't really see how they get in, right? They just sort of, like, appear at the prom. They walk, like, around the corner, and, like, they're at prom. And then next time you see them, they're sneaking backstage. And
they're backstage because they're about to announce the prom king and prom queen.
And the whole plan, it's revealed, is there is no plan. Which I
exactly.
I love that, actually. I love the balls on that kid to be like, I got a plan, man. I got this. And then they get there and it's like, this is the plan. We're here.
And the plan is there is no plan.
Crowned king and queen, though, right?
Well, as they're getting crowned king and queen, in the longest and most awkward and depressing speech ever given at prom, pretty much, this faculty member who wished she was prom queen and wasn't, and is sort of reminiscing of a past she didn't have, Nick Cage just starts fighting Tommy.
He says, I'm going to give you the chance that I never had.
Which doesn't make sense.
I don't understand that, because he's kicked Nick Cage's ass like twice at this point. He's like,
yeah,
he's had this chance. But yeah, you're right. Nick Cage just like sucker punches him. And Tommy doesn't flinch. He starts busting out like kung fu moves.
Yeah, because like, so Nick Cage gets off one punch, and then the second punch, Tommy just like arm blocks and then counters. Like, it's crazy. Like, there's like fight choreography for this fight between two high school kids.
I'm thinking Johnny now from Karate Kid, you know, the blonde bully and this blonde bully. I'm like, was karate like something?
I guess karate was big in the 80s.
Like, it was big for bullies to know karate.
And so then eventually Nick Cage knocks Tommy down, drags him off stage, and then nobody in the crowd seems to react to the fact that Nick Cage is there. I guess most of them don't know who he is.
It's kind of a strange, I love it because it feels so real, but it's definitely an awkward moment when the band starts playing, the king and queen are announced, and the curtains are drawn, and you see Nick Cage and Tommy fighting. You know,
and like, nobody reacts.
It's like almost a moment out of The Office where it's just like, this is so awkward and strange. What is going on? It's not fitting the flow of anything. But then he knocks out Tommy and like, I love how he drags him and then takes his place as prom king.
And then they run down, and then, you know, Tommy recovers and his friends come after them. And then they take these plates of just what looks like, you know, cake icing. It doesn't look like there's food. It's just like icing on a plate.
Yeah.
And they're just throwing icing.
Food fight, big time. I mean, that's their big escape plan is like, I'm going to start a food fight and you crawl out under the table.
Which is great. That's super smooth. They don't go over. They go under, which is real classy. And they duck out. And then they sneak into the car that Tommy and Julie came. And they drive off into the sunset.
Or into the moonlight.
In a final shot that reminded me of The Graduate.
Yes.
That she's in this white dress, he's in this suit, but instead of being like the most awkward and sort of depressing, this isn't what we bargained for, this is exactly what they both wanted.
Yeah, it was a nice nod, and it was sort of a reversal, right? Like, they took the same concept, and instead of making it depressing, well, it wasn't depressing, but they made it a hopeful shot at the end. I love that. There's also a Graduate reference earlier on when Skip delivers the groceries and the mom's seducing him. She goes, she says something about plastics. Did you catch that?
Yeah, I think I heard that. I don't know if I caught the reference.
In the Graduate, when they have the party in the beginning, you know,
yeah.
He goes out and the guy's like, let me give you a little bit of advice. Plastics. It's like a famous line from The Graduate.
Okay.
So the mom just drops a line from The Graduate hoping that the kid is going to pick up the hint that she wants to play Mrs. Robinson, you know? But, you know, it's the joke is that, like, he's too young to have seen The Graduate, so he doesn't understand the line.
I feel like that's, like, another example of, like, people in this movie living through other movies.
Mm.
That, like, you know, the dad is doing Apocalypse Now, Susie's mom is doing The Graduate, all these parents are, like, living other movies, and they're not really too subtle about it. Like, they're just sort of like, hey, these are the people that you know, like, these are like the references that to movies that everybody's seen. This is just what's happening, and it's just gonna happen.
It's interesting. I don't really think of older movies in that way, but they do that nowadays with comedies a lot, and I don't necessarily like it when they allude to popular movies of the day, but they're
right.
Doing it here, and it feels natural to a degree. I don't know why that is. Maybe just because we're older and more aware.
But yeah, so that's Valley Girl. I really liked it. I still think that, you know, of the three movies we watched, I think my favorite is still Fast Times, but this is the first real Nick Cage vehicle that we've seen. It's the first of many that we're going to see where he's in the driver's seat. This is all pretty much about him. It's also about, you know, Valley Girl herself, but this is sort of his first real deal.
Yeah, his leading male, his first male leading role.
And he's 18 years old. Like, it's weird to me. Like, nowadays, it's rare that, I don't even know if it ever happens. I'm sure there are examples. But it doesn't seem like there's anybody who just comes out of nowhere to, like, star in a movie.
Well, you know what they do? They usually find someone that they could wrangle for, like, four movies, and they become, like, the face of a franchise.
Like that new, like the new Spider-Man kid.
Well, I'm thinking like Twilight, where the kid who played I'm not very good with those movies. I don't know the guy who played the lead vampire. You know, it's like
Robert Pattinson.
Pattinson. Like he could have been probably like a very promising actor, except that he sort of got pigeonholed into being the Twilight vampire. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, it's strange. Like he basically came out of nowhere. He was, and we talked about this on other episodes, he was the second lead in a TV show. He was going to be basically, you know, one of the three or four big stars of the next movie, and then he's the star of his next movie. Okay. Like, it's such a rise to sort of prominence so quickly.
Yeah, and I heard in the special features that Judd Nelson was up for his role in this movie.
Oh yeah, you listened to the director's commentary. Was there anything worth sharing from that?
A couple things, I suppose. This movie was shot in 20 days.
Wow, that's really fast.
Yeah, they had under 300, under, I think it was under $400,000 at the time to shoot the whole movie. I listened to the director's commentary, but I wasn't really trying to pull, like, too many facts.
Sure.
To load it up.
I mean, did she drop any, like, real juicy cage nuggets or not really?
Okay, so this was a pretty cool story she told that he was filming Rumblefish at the same time that filming this movie. And he's like, you know, I don't know if I could get the time off from that movie to do this movie. And she's like, well, the director, Martha Coolidge, it comes from Zoetrope Productions. And Zoetrope is Francis Ford Coppola's production company. And she goes to Nick Cage. She goes, oh, I know Francis. I know the director. We're like family. Like, let me talk to him. Let me try and see if I could get you out of the deal. And she said Nick Cage gave her this look like he couldn't understand what was happening, right? And he just sort of walks out. And she tells the story, making a phone call to be like, you know, I need Nick Cage. And they're like, there is no Nick Cage on this movie. There's Nick Coppola.
Right.
And everybody had a big laugh. And Francis just thought it was hilarious. So, you know, sure enough, they made the schedules work.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I thought that was pretty cool.
So that's, I guess, like really like the moment in time or right around then where he actually sort of made the name transition.
Oh, I guess we'll find out in Rumblefish what is he credited as. Maybe
I think he's Nick Cage.
He must have had to do some 11th hour editing on the credits for that movie to change his name.
Yeah, it's, I don't know. But yeah, so Rumblefish is the next movie that we're going to be doing. So this was the end of the first week of Cage Club. I hope you all enjoyed it. So next week, their schedule is going to be Rumblefish, Racing with the Moon, and The Cotton Club. Three movies that I've never seen. Two that I don't even know if I've heard of before I started looking for all of his movies. Have you seen any of these three movies?
I've seen Rumblefish once. Racing with the Moon, I've seen parts of, but never in its entirety. And I wasn't aware he was in it when I was watching it. And then The Cotton Club I did see once also about somewhere around like 2006, 2007, and I don't remember much of it.
So it seems like next week will be totally fresh for me and still pretty fresh for you.
Yeah.
And that's exactly the kind of week that we like to see here on Cage Club. So any last thoughts about Valley Girl that we didn't get to?
No, I think everyone should check it out.
Yeah, I agree. Doesn't look like it's available anywhere. But the DVD is really cheap on Amazon. Valley Girl is definitely worth checking out. I really liked it a lot. So that's a good end of the episode. That is Mike Manzi. I'm Joey Lewandowski. Hope you enjoyed. See you next week. There's nothing new.